People from underrepresented groups in graduate school sometimes face challenges that are different from those who may be better resourced and who have families and friends who have gone down the grad school gauntlet. What advice is valid for all grad school applicants? What challenges are unique to BIPOC applicants? The authors of Is Grad School for Me will fill us all in.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 575th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for tuning in. The challenge at the heart of grad school admissions is showing that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. Accept its free download, Fitting In and Standing Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions, will show you how to do both. Master this paradox and you are well on your way to acceptance. You can download this free guide at accept.com/FISO for Fitting In and Standing Out. Our guests today are Dr. Yvette Martinez-Vu, a grad school and productivity coach and host of the globally top-rated grad school femtoring podcast. She's also the co-editor of the best-selling Chicana Motherwork Anthology, co-author of Is Grad School for Me? Demystifying the Application Process for First-Gen BIPOC Students, and founder of Grad School Femtoring LLC. In that latter position, she coaches first-gen BIPOC folks in reaching their academic and personal goals. Dr. Miroslava Chavez-Garcia is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is currently the faculty director of the UCSB McNair Scholars Program. She's author of Migrant Longing, States of Delinquency, and Negotiating Conquest, and co-author of Is Grad School for Me? Demystifying the Application Process for First-Gen BIPOC Students. Dr. Chavez-Garcia and Dr. Martinez-Vu, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
My pleasure. I'm delighted you can join me and why don't we can talk together. Now, what I'd like to do is first discuss your advice that applies to all grad students, a kind of the foundation, and then focus on the specific challenges faced by BIPOC applicants, as well as your suggestions for overcoming them. And of course, I'd like to hear how you came to write Is Grad School for Me? So let's start with a very basic question, the easy question. What are good and bad reasons for pursuing a grad degree? And Dr. Martinez-Vu, why don't you start?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question are all the many bad reasons that sometimes individuals find themselves when they're applying to graduate school. And when I think about bad reasons, I think about a lot of external reasons that may not be directly tied to what they need to do to pursue the career path and life they want. So I'm thinking someone who's saying, oh, I'm going to apply to grad school because I want to delay my job search because the job market is terrible. Or I want to go to graduate school because my friend or my mom told me to do it. Or I want to go to graduate school because I have this romanticized view about what it looks like to have a career in academia. And trust me, behind the scenes, it's not always pretty. And then, of course, there's some folks who are afraid of facing reality, like post-college reality. They want to keep deferring their student loans. And so they find that as another option to do that. And I don't think those are great.
Right. We had a son who kind of tried to go down that path and ended up not doing it. But yeah, he definitely wanted to postpone adulthood.
See?
He will remain nameless.
Yes, he will.
Yeah. Now, for the good reasons, I will say that usually when folks ask me, I say it's a very personal decision, but there are some two solid good reasons to apply to graduate school. The first one is if you absolutely need it to pursue the career that you want and or to advance in your career. That's a very good reason. Second is an intrinsic reason, meaning you feel that sense of calling, you have someone who asks a lot of questions, you might even identify as a scholar, you know that if you don't pursue this, you will always have that what if in the back of your head. What if I had gotten that advanced degree? If you know it's always going to bother you and going to be that thing in the back of your head, then that might be a decent reason to apply to graduate school. Anything else, it's hard for me to justify.
Yeah, I'll add one other thing to that.
Please do.
something that we discuss in the book and how important it is when thinking about whether grad school is for you and the right decision, right? So along with wanting to use it for a career move, I think what's really important to realize that grad school is a really, was a place where you gain knowledge, right, in your field. There'll be structure for you to follow these steps to achieve your goals and your objectives. And also it'll be great networking opportunities. So you'll get to meet people who are interested in your field, who perhaps already have connections established and so forth. So it's just a good place. That's kind of a step a little bit further into that, what you can expect from a doctoral or a master's program, grad school.
Right. I noticed in your books that you discuss both the good and the bad reasons. And in addition to my personal experience, I've been an advocate all along that you have to have, unless one can afford to just pursue that calling, that interest, you have to have a goal that justifies the cost.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's again, on the good side. Now, once you have that goal and you have that good reason, or you can justify the calling, the yearning, how should applicants go about choosing a program and schools to apply to? And Dr. Chavez-Garcia, why don't you start with that one?
Sure. Thanks. I think one of the important things to begin is to sort of look at the specializations within your field. So do a scan if you can of the different programs around the country, or just depending on what sort of where you're thinking you're going to end up or where you're willing to move to. But look at those institutions, those places, those programs, and do they offer those curriculum or experience that meet your needs and interests? So that's really important. Like, is that a good fit for what I want to do? The second thing I would say to look at is, do they have faculty with whom you could see yourself forming a relationship with? Faculty who look like, perhaps, you know, you might see that, for me, it's always really important, the mirrors. Is there a potential for role models in this institution? So that's really important. Look at the location of the institution. Where is it? Is it a rural, urban? Is it in a part of the state that you live in that is perhaps where you do not want to end up? Or what is the nature? Is it a private? Is it a public institution? What kind of costs are you looking at? Is it an HSI, Hispanic serving institution, which means there's 25% or more are of Hispanic descent? Or is it what people call PWI, primarily white institution? Or there's other right kind of markers of diversity in terms of different groups. So that's important to think about. Like, who do you want your peers to be? Another one that's really important, I think, for grad school students in particular, maybe not so much with undergrads, but graduate students tend to leave the campus, right? They're looking for community beyond their departments, because usually in their departments they're the only ones, or very few, maybe a few students of color, a few first gen, few BIPOC students. And so they're really looking for that community. And the question is, like, will they find those spaces? What kinds of places can they go and have a drink or a coffee and relax? Is that important to you? Maybe not. Maybe you're just going to be in your lab 24/7, because if you're in the STEM fields, that happens a lot. But for the majority of people, at least I know in the social sciences and humanities, they do want to be able to go and, you know, kick up their heels, or just, you know, leave the identity of the graduate student behind and have sort of another kind of experience. And so that's important. Of course, things like housing. What does housing look like? Is it guaranteed or not? Usually they do guarantee the first year. Sometimes some places are even saying, we're not sure we can even do that. But that becomes, at least in California, I know that's especially on my campus, where it's kind of touch and go all of the time. Yeah. And so just in short, research the school, research the environment, use the internet to talk to people. Reach out to the department, see if you can contact the alumni. Sometimes they'll let you talk to alumni and so forth.
Okay, great. Dr. Martinez, do you have anything to add to that?
I do. So I want to echo what Dr. Miroslava said about making sure that you can find faculty. And I want to kind of expand on that, because I think that sometimes the tendency for new applicants is to go to Google or to go to the US News and Reports site and try to find the top institutions in their field and call it a day. And sometimes I take a look at grad school lists and it's all the top programs and there's no column for who they're going to work with. And so I say, okay, take a look at the research that you've done. Take a look at what you've written about. Who are the overarching scholars that keep coming up over and over again? Where are they? Where did they study and get their PhD in? Similarly, who can you consult within your greater network? That might be graduate students who have served as your TAs. That might be professors who have taught classes for you. And even branching outside of your current institution to contacting the faculty and grad students at the institutions you're interested in to find out if it even makes sense to apply there. Those are all things I want to kind of remind folks, or let them know if they didn't know previously, that you are allowed to ask people questions, reach out to them before you apply. And I also want to say that it's okay if you have a regional restriction, if you have to stay within one location, but just please make sure wherever you apply that you can find faculty who are going to vouch for you, who are going to advocate for you, because your advisors, your committee members, and even the folks in your department will, they could potentially make or break your experience in graduate school.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Great points. Really good points. What about in terms of choosing a graduate program, looking at your own qualifications and comparing them to the class profile of the program, if that information is available? For professional schools, it tends to be available. For academic programs, it's sometimes not so easy to find. What would you say to that? Dr. Martinez-Vouve, you want to go first on that one?
Oh, can you rephrase that question for me?
Well, how about matching your qualifications with the typical qualifications of applicants to a particular program? Are you qualified for the program before applying?
I see.
Are you competitive?
Yeah, that's something to take a look at. Not every website will indicate this, which can make it difficult to find out, do I have a competitive GPA? Do I have a competitive GRE score? But if you can't find that information, there's no one saying that you cannot reach out to find out that information. So I always recommend that you become best friends with whoever that staff person is in that department. Usually they're called graduate advisors. Sometimes they have a different title. It's that contact us at person, whatever email address they provide, and ask them questions, because most of the time they're not the ones selecting you, but they also have a lot of insider knowledge about that department. So you can ask, if it's okay to ask, what is the average GRE score? What is the average GPA for admitted students? That way you can get a sense, am I within that range? Am I really off? And if not, is it realistic for me to apply here?
That's a great suggestion.
Can I add one thing to that?
Of course.
I think that's really important, a really good way for them to know you're interested. And I think a lot of faculty welcome these questions that they get from the staff graduate advisor who was, there's just kind of a sweet spot. I mean, you don't want to ask so many questions and the faculty go, will this person be like the, I mean, what is it, somebody we're going to have to really, you know, sort of watch and maneuver every single step, or is it somebody who could, who's asking very smart and right questions? So I think, not that there's a dumb question, but you know, I think it's important to figure that out. But definitely I like that approach that Yvette suggests.
Well, if the question is answered on the first page of the website, it may not be a great question.
Right. always make sure you check the website first before asking anything.
Right. And the other thing I remember years ago, you said to make best friends with the person that picks up the phone. I think it's a great suggestion. But I once had a client call me up that he got into an argument with the person who answered the phone. And then to multiply his stupidity, he called the director of the admissions office and complained about her. And then he asked me if I thought he still had a chance at that particular school. It's a true story. And I said, I didn't think so. No. I also suggested that not everything in his head has to come out of his mouth, which is a good thing to remember when you're being evaluated.
Yes.
But anyways, let's move on. How should applicants prepare academically for grad school? I mean, do they have to have the same major? Do they have to have done research in the area? Do they have to have good grades, competitive grades? They have the GRE. What if the GRE is optional? And Dr. Chavez Garcia, do you want to start this one?
Sure. I think one of the very important things to sort of forefront is your research experience, right? So you want to put that out there, talk about what you've done, how you've contributed to an area of research or an area field, an area of production of knowledge. Ultimately, that's, you know, research producing knowledge, and how you've been able to do that in different ways. So also you might be able to talk about, and I'll get to this point about not having this experience, but you can also talk about any kind of research experience you've participated in as a participant. What did that look like? So that's something you want to talk about. But also, I think, as we discuss in the book, and I think it's a point that Yvette has raised with me, because I come from the academic side where I'm like research. She's also talked a lot about how you don't always have to have that formal research experience. Right? So in the book, we talk about how you can use your real world experience approximating research in terms of perhaps the questions you might ask, perhaps the methods that you invoke to answer those questions, right? And the kind of the innovative approach. So sometimes I think in academia, we get stuck in the same four methods, right? Let's do the same method, or let's just, and so we can't figure out the answer because we're just stuck in the same rut. But I think sometimes people who come from different spaces and diverse spaces that are not represented in the academy, sometimes have new ideas or different ideas hadn't thought about. It's like, you know, you say one thing, they're like, huh, I hadn't, it's just the, when I just heard it recently. Huh, I hadn't thought about that. And I thought, like, what a basic thing to think about, but okay. So yeah, don't discount yourself because you don't have that formal research in the lab or, you know, digging out, you know, digging for bones or whatever kind of thing. There's different ways that you can position yourself. So
could you give an example of like,
yeah,
experience sure. being relevant, but surprising?
Right. Well, I'll say just one thing that we thought about was community organizing, that being a big one, right? When you are, you have a goal, you want to fight against an incinerator that's being put in your neighborhood, which is based on some of the mothers of East LA who, you know, fought in Boyle Heights many decades ago to do this. The women got their information together. They got hundreds and several thousands of people organized. All of that work takes a lot of effort and ingenuity. And I think the biggest success that they've had and people, it's difficult, is how to communicate and how to draw people together. That's something to be said for what they were able to do. So I think that using those kinds of experiences to speak well, I mean, have you done that kind of work in different, I'm not saying just going out and trying to, you know, change the world or revolution, but when have you tackled these big problems and how have you done that? And what were the outcomes? I think that's important as well. I hate to use that word in academia. We love outcomes and assessment. I'm like, oh, you know, essentially people want to know now if they're investing in you, this is how they look at it. Are they getting their return? That's the way it's now been corporatized.
Like,
I mean, it is. Essentially, you have to show what you, or they're not going to invest in you. That's the way it goes. But lastly, I will say, we don't recommend trying to cram for grad school. I mean, at this point, but rather present what you have and be ready to absorb this new information. And certainly there are resources to help you do that, because it is, I'll just speak from my own personal experience. The first year was a hard transition, like any new place, but yeah.
Right. Dr. Martinez-Wu, do you have anything to add to that?
I feel like that was a really thorough answer that she gave, but I do want to add, again, another nod to the importance of developing solid relationships with faculty, because that was one of the things that came up for me that was a struggle when I was in undergrad, is that I had no idea that by the time I was applying to graduate school, I would be required to have 3 letters of rec. And up to that point, I was that student who thought that I was bothering professors. I didn't know that office hours were for me. I thought they were hours for them to work on their work. And as a result, I probably didn't have the strongest letters, just to be frank. And so I just want to remind students to start thinking about that early on. If you're a freshman, if you're a sophomore, if you're a junior for sure, who are the 3 people that I want to intentionally form a strong relationship with, so that hopefully they will be able to write you a letter for graduate school and perhaps for other opportunities.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah. One more thing, just in relationship to letters recommendation, a lot of the folks that we're speaking to in the book aren't necessarily coming straight from undergrad, right? They're non-traditional students. So then the question happens, like, or comes up, what do I do? I haven't been in school for years. Where do I find those letters of rec? So for that, I would say, and maybe Yvette has another idea as well, is to check with the campus, the institution, or the program you're going to apply to. Would they be willing to accept 1, maybe 2 from a professional, somebody who's not in academia? Sometimes they allow for that. Or maybe they will allow you to bring those as additional. So it just depends. I mean, I don't know if Yvette has another ideas, because that does get difficult.
I also encourage them not to be afraid to reach out to contacts that they haven't been in touch with for a while. And if you're going to make that ask, to check in with them, to schedule a meeting so that they will remember you, or so that they have some familiarity on who you are and what you've been up to. And a lot of times, if you did well in a class, or if you worked with them previously, even if it was many years ago, many professors would be more than willing to support you in that way.
Right. You should also remind them what they did, and also realize that it depends a little bit on the degree you're pursuing. If you're pursuing a degree in academia, right, then they really do want an academic rec. But if you're going for an MBA, they don't want academic recs.
Exactly. Yes.
So, you know, keep that in mind. They specifically don't want them. They want the boss. They want the supervisor, somebody that you've worked with. So, you know, you have to know those requirements also, but certainly for most graduate programs, They are going to want at least one academic rec, and many will want exclusively academic recs.
Right. And usually the PhD, sometimes grad students, you're the closest to a graduate student, but it could be maybe you ask the grad student to work with a faculty member to write a letter for you. I mean, we say a lot in the book about letters of recommendation. We can maybe come to this later, but
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Now, more and more programs, especially US programs, they obviously want, you know, the student to have had good grades, and we've, you know, touched quite a bit on the importance of research, especially if you're going to research oriented programs. But how are they supposed to prepare experientially? And research would be part of that experiential component. And let's look at some different kinds of degrees. So let's look first at professional terminal degrees like the MBA, the JD, the MD. And I realize that in listing those three degrees, they're very different degrees with their very different requirements. But what is the experiential component there? And then we'll get to academic masters and academic PhDs. Okay. Yeah. So Dr. Chavez Garcia, do you want to take this one? I think I'm not sure I'm going the right order, but
I think Yvette's first.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm happy to start with the MBA, JD, MD, and then maybe Meadles can transition to talking about the master's and PhD programs.
Fine. That's fine with me.
Okay. So I want to just mention a quick caveat that the book is written particularly for preparing for master's and PhD programs. And these are more academic master's and PhD programs. However, I'm happy to talk about the MBA, JD, MD option because I have worked with those types of applicants. And so when you're applying to these professional type programs, it is important to have work experience. And in medical settings, it's important to have clinical experience. And so this might look like having an internship at some sort of legal office. It might, that would be for the JD. It might look like a volunteering at a hospital if you know that you want to go for the MD. It might look like securing a part-time job working at a pharmacy if you know you want to go to pharmacy school, because you want to show that you have familiarity and experience in the field. You don't want to make it seem like it's just this dream and all you did was just go to school, take classes. And also, I don't want to discount that there are some of these professional programs that do have a research component. There are medical schools that have that research emphasis. And so if that's the case, there are even joint degree programs, JD, PhD programs. So if you know there's a research component, or if you know it's a joint program, I would also make sure to stress the research that we mentioned earlier, making sure that you have it or that you develop that research experience in some way, shape, or form. I think that's all I want to say about the,
All right.
I didn't mention specific MBA examples, but you get what I mean in terms of having direct experience and also having letter writers that can prove that you have that experience as well.
For MBA, basically the applicant has to have at least two, preferably three years of full-time work experience for the traditional full-time MBA program. Otherwise, they're not really competitive until they get it. There are some deferred MBA programs, but it's a whole different kettle of fish.
There are some PhD programs like that too, right? Like the clinical counseling programs that more and more now require.
PsyD programs.
Yeah. They require that you have that clinical experience before they even admit you. Yeah.
So the physician assistant programs, they have pretty heavy experience requirements.
Right.
But let's focus on the academics, since the book is kind of what triggered this podcast, and we're gonna stick with that now going forward. So Dr. Chavez Garcia,
I'll address that, and hopefully Yvette can also, because this is kind of this question here about what kind of experience do you need for master's or PhD programs? Is that kind of the question, right?
That's the question.
Prepare? Yeah. So it does vary. I think it varies by fields and so forth. But definitely, I think the first thing in thinking about a master's program, as we know, those are generally 2 to 3 years. There's a lot of teaching programs that are 1 year or like 15, 16 months. Those are teacher education programs, but those are a little bit different. So I would say to look at the programs and look at the major milestones of the program and how and when generally students achieve those points, right? So, and then thinking about what you can bring to the program. So for instance, master's programs, sometimes they require to get the master's to do an exam, or sometimes they require a master's thesis. So an actual written document that can be anywhere from 50 to 150 pages. So thinking about those different kinds of programs and what might work best for you and where your strengths are. And I think the same thing would be for the PhD, to look at the timelines and how people sort of get through those timelines. What are the major milestones? through those programs, whether it's, you know, coursework, different kinds of exams, putting together a proposal for your thesis, your dissertation, and so all that step and how long that would take. Also thinking about funding and how important that is. So that those are also things to look at in terms of how you will be able to sort of move through the program. I'm not sure if I'm answering the experience that you need to bring, because I kind of think we addressed that a little bit before.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I think the only other thing I would just say when thinking about your experience, what you to think beforehand before you're going into these programs and applying, like, what is your idea? Do you plan to go into industry, or do you plan to stay with the academic track? Do you want to teach at a university or a college? And so I think it's important to have an idea about that. I read some of the latest research, latest studies shows that nearly half of PhDs go into non-academic jobs. So like 48-49% do not. So it's gone, it's increased over the years, which is nothing new, I think, for us to hear, but to see those numbers increase, to tick up, that fewer and fewer people go into academia is just the reality. Right. So it's difficult to land those jobs. But there are opportunities, I would say, particularly for first-gen BIPOC students, when institutions are looking to sort of bring in fresh idea and fresh faces into these largely, as I said earlier, homogeneous spaces. I think there's more wiggle room and more space for that.
Okay, great. Let's move on to the application itself. What are your top tips for the most common writing components of the application, which for a grad school would be the statement of purpose, increasingly a diversity statement, and some graduate programs want both a statement of purpose and a personal statement. So Dr. Martinez, Wu, you started first. So Dr. Chavez-Garcia, let's start with you for this question.
So I think for grad programs, it's primarily, yeah, the statement of purpose and the personal statement. The diversity statement, I haven't seen it too often, perhaps, but I think it's more like when you get an academic job or a job, like a lecturer or academic job. But the first thing I would want to say is to make sure these documents, whatever you end up to write, are separate statements. Make sure to keep them separate. Avoid repetition and take full advantage of the space that you have been given, because sometimes it's also very limited. They'll say 500 words, 700 words. So use that to your advantage. You know, do not try not to replicate as much as possible. And the second thing I would say is to launch into your pieces with a bold statement, right? It doesn't have to be something like, you know, crazy, but I think an argument of sorts that you will then support with evidence is really important. Right? Don't wander, don't be shy, don't sort of just muddle. You know, I think it's important to sort of say something strong. Also be careful not being overconfident and then not have anything to show for it. Like, you don't want to do that either. So it's important to realize that reviewers or whoever your audience is, they don't want to search for something what you're trying to say. It's not like a guessing game. They're going to give up very easily, or I know because I've reviewed lots of applications, or I'm just going to assume that you don't know what you want, or you're not really being serious because you're wasting our time because you're not telling us exactly what you want. So I think the statement of purpose, first of all, is focus on your research, on your goal, your research goals, and what you plan to contribute to what we already don't, to what we don't know. Right? So what are you bringing new to the table? What do you hope to bring to the table? So that is what the statement of purpose is about, like what you're going to do. Sometimes you might want to weave in the research experience. Some places will ask you for a separate document on research experience, but mostly you want to say in the statement of purpose, this is what I've done, or this is what I hope to do. This is the kind of research I've done, and this is my new contributions that I hope to make in the future. It doesn't have to be set in stone. You're not going to be held to this document if you get in year two. Where are you? It's just, can you craft a statement that shows that you know what these components look like, right? And then I'll move on to this personal statement that talks about your personal experience and how that shaped your research interests or your research trajectory. Perhaps something happened when you were a child, a formative event, then sort of led you to, you know, look at the ingredients in, I don't know, baby shampoo or something like that, right? Maybe something happened to you, those kinds of things. So it's really asking them about making that connection between the personal and your research and how that bridge is sort of logical and how you got there. And lastly, I'll say the diversity statement for those, you know, who need to write them. Those talk about your commitment to diversity and how you have done that. So showing specifically how you have contributed to diversifying academia, how you've created pipelines for, you know, elementary students, you've created pathways for non-traditional students. Have you tutored? Have you worked in these different spaces? You know, just how have you done that? How is that shown? I know in my diversity statements, I will actually talk about my research, how it's that contributes to diversity, how my teaching contributes to diversity, and my service, which is, I'm not making these things up. It's all in the name of diversifying the professoriate. That's, as a professor, that's what I my mission, really. Yvette's an expert on this, so let her.
Do you want to add now?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to add a couple of things. I'll try to keep it brief. So going back to the statement of purpose, echoing what Miros just mentioned, I do think it's important to start with an overarching thread or some sort of hook. Nowadays, folks have really short attention spans. You don't know how many dozens, if not hundreds of applications someone is combing through. So it's important for you to be able to pinpoint, you know, how you're making sense of your trajectory and what came up for you that helped you to make sense of getting from point A, where you started, wherever that was, to point B, you getting to the point of applying. So storytelling is an often underemphasized aspect that's important for these statements, not just a statement of purpose. I would also say, in addition to prioritizing and emphasizing mentioning your previous research and or work experience, to also make sure that you do your research to indicate why this is the right program for you. Mm-hmm. So that might include mentioning faculty, that might include mentioning specializations. Is there a special internship? Is there field work? Is there, are there resources on that campus or in that greater community that make this the right program for you? And then for the personal statement, don't forget to figure out, you know, what are your greater values, greater mission? What are the overarching themes again in your life that might come from formative experiences? And if you struggle to name this, talk it out with a friend or someone who can help you to name them, and make sure to highlight other ways that you have prepared for graduate school that you didn't get to highlight in your statement of purpose. Right. And it's also a great opportunity if you need to identify and justify a gap on your application. You know, you have low GPA score or a low GRE score. Maybe there was one semester or quarter that you really struggled. It could be a great place for you to mention what was going on, what you did to overcome that, or how you're actively working towards overcoming that obstacle. And then lastly, diversity statement. You know, I was going to say the same thing that Miro said about make sure that you can highlight how you are diversifying spaces through either your identity, through your research, through your teaching, through your service work, because a lot of times the folks that we work with, they think, just look at me. Of course, I'm going to diversify a space. And it's not as simple as that. Or sometimes folks don't see themselves represented in that. They're like, how am I going to diversify this space? Or they feel like they haven't actively worked towards diversifying these spaces. And in that case, I would say, think broadly about how you define diversity. And two, if you haven't done the work, talk about how you plan to do that in the future. And that's it.
Yeah, I would add one of the things. Definitely no statement of purpose looks the same. No, there are no two alike. There shouldn't be. Certainly there's key elements to those that need to go in, but it is good to look at sample ones, of course, to get inspiration to see. And also I think by field, I do think in the STEM fields, they do look differently in terms of the language. It's not always, I love narrative, I'm a historian. Narrative can be an asset that you bring to the STEM fields, of course. I mean, that would be, that's if it's you though. I mean, ultimately it's you on the paper and you want to make sure you want to be true to yourself at the same time, because if you're trying to pretend you're somebody else, why would you want to be at that institution? So look at a sample. I think it's really important in your field just to get a sense of what the range is.
And your book has several samples in it.
Yes. Yes.
Both personal statements and statements of purpose. So,
And a few diversity.
Right. Okay. All right. Now let's turn to your book now that I just mentioned it. First, can you tell us a little bit about the challenges you faced in applying to graduate school? And Dr. Martinez Vu, do you want to start with this one?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
I do think that we have nodded a little bit to some of the challenges that we experienced, which is what motivated, inspired us to write this book. So one of the things that Miros and I have both said time and time again is that both of us felt in undergrad as we were preparing for graduate school that we were stumbling along the way, that we didn't know what we didn't know, and that we were just barely trying to figure things out. And for me, I often felt like I was figuring things out and often at the last minute. So that was really, really hard, is just constantly feeling like I just didn't know what was coming next. The next thing that came up for me, which I mentioned earlier, is that I didn't have strong ties with faculty. And I am, you know, it's one of those things that I could, if I could go back in time and change that, I really would have. I just didn't know any better. And I was very introverted and kept to myself. I also struggled with selecting the program that I ultimately went to because I ended up working with an advisor, my first advisor, that just wasn't the right fit for me. And I wish I would have had the opportunity to meet the people that I was considering working with before saying yes. That would have helped me a lot, helped me to avoid a lot of heartache and turmoil.
I'm sure.
And then another thing, just to put it out there, because I know this is something that can come up, especially for low-income first-gen students, is that I completely bombed my GRE. I did. I have never had a record of performing well in standardized tests. I didn't have the financial support to take a test prep course or even hire a tutor. And as a result, that led to me not getting the best score. Ultimately, it didn't, you know, get in the way of me pursuing a PhD, but it certainly didn't help me.
Might have caused a little bit of stress along the way.
Oh yeah.
It was awful. The GRE, back in my day, we did paper and pencil, and it was like, stop, go, stop. You couldn't even put your pencil down, and you were like, you know,
I took the GMAT.
Oh wow.
I'm dating myself, but when I was going to college and grad school, courses were not a thing. So I hadn't taken I took one math class in college, and I remember I got a book to review before taking the GMAT, but the courses existed, like Kaplan existed, Princeton Review existed, but the common wisdom was that they were really for people who are desperate. And right. that they don't, you know, that was the common wisdom at the time. So by the time I had kids applying, it had changed entirely.
Yeah, but, I remember when I was interested in getting one of those courses, because I was, you know, in the early 90s, it was at the time it cost like $800 or $900. And I think it's still not actually gone up that much more than that. But I called and I said, like, do you guys provide some sort of assistance or something? This isn't like it was reverse discrimination or something like that. I thought, like, what is $900? I can't even, you know, so yeah. Yeah, that was tough. That was awful.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on. By the way, I'm first generation. My parents are both immigrants, and neither one went to college. They were refugees. So I can relate to some of the challenges that you're mentioning here. One of the more interesting phrases I've come across in the last 10 years ago or so is imposter syndrome. And I didn't remember reading about it before then, but what is imposter syndrome and what is its role in the admissions process for first-gen applicants, in your opinion? And Dr. Chavez Garcia, you can start with that one.
Sure. We also talk about imposter syndrome as sort of imposter phenomenon, sort of helps depersonalize it, you know, make it more structural, look at it sort of within a bird's eye of the institution, within an institutional focus. But it's this belief or this idea that you don't belong, right? That somehow you've sort of faked your way, or that you fool people into letting you into these spaces that are not meant for you. And so it's this sort of constant belief that you're going to be found out. And then once they find out that you don't really belong, that somehow you got there with not on your own sort of merits, that you're going to be rejected, that you're going to be told to leave, and so forth. So it's not just a feeling, actually, I would say. Like, it's more than just sort of like this idea that it's in your head. And that's why I think people, now we talk about it as phenomenon, that it's actually, it's very real, right? Especially when you enter these spaces and these rooms and no one looks like you or talks like you or not necessarily acts like you, but there's a certain, even, you know, so the culture is very different. And sometimes you step into a room and you have to say, like, oh, well, I'm sorry, did I enter the wrong room? And it's in your head, you're thinking, like, is this the place? Is this the right space for me? So I think that that's something that happens. And certainly when we're, I think it stops a lot of us from applying to graduate school in the first place, you know, or sometimes, in my experience, it wasn't so much there where it sort of jumped out of me. I think it's being seated around people and thinking, like, or going to the admissions, like the preview day, looking at others, as people sizing each other up. And certainly on the first days of the seminars, I still remember people using these big words. Somebody said, like, in my first year of an intro course to the PhD program with a very well-known established historian at UCLA, and somebody said, oh, it's such a Hegelian whatever example. I was like, wow, that sounds impressive. No.
Can I look it up?
Yeah. But she called him on it, which was kind of cool. So yeah, I think that it's very real. It's something that continues to plague, I'll say, myself, even at this point. And I always wonder, like, one of my former undergrad students who now has a PhD, African-American student, and who also comes from a low-income neighborhood. So he says, Dr. Meadows, do you experience? I'm like, no, I don't have the imposter phenomenon. And then I thought, wait a minute, why did I kill myself? I hurt, like literally put myself in the hospital after wanting to get these books out and wanting to do all this work. It's because I feel I still need to prove it to the, you know, to the powers that be, and even myself, perhaps, that I belong. And so, the studies show that women of color in particular in academia have horrible rates in terms of like health concerns and, you know, all these issues. So,
all right. Dr. Martinez Wu, do you have anything to add on that?
I think that was a solid answer. So I'm happy to move on.
Okay. When I first read imposter syndrome, imposter phenomenon, I read about it in terms of syndrome. It was by, I can't remember the author's name, but he was basically saying that that's a feeling that indicates you're trying to grow. Mm. You're trying to improve yourself. In other words, there is a positive side to that.
Yes. I would agree.
And that you're not, you know, I don't know, celebrate might be too.
Yeah.
Strong of word, but maybe the feeling should be embraced, acknowledged as a sign of I'm trying to change myself. I'm trying to grow. I'm trying to do better.
Right. It's kind of like how you look at the glass, what they say, right? So it's
right.
But it can also be a little bit of deficit thinking, but I guess it depends on the person, because I really drive myself hard. Also immigrant, you know, I lost both my parents when I was young. So it's myself. And I'm like, I'm here to prove it to my parents and to all these people. And so I always see myself as, not good enough, right? And even I was in sports in college too, and our coach was always pushing us hard. We won Pac-10 champions and all this, and went to nationals. But it really broke some people. Mm. Not everybody survived that. Different people have different spirits, and so it just depends on who you are. Some people thrive off competition and in your face, and kind of like I do. I love competition. I love like I'm gonna beat you. But some people don't work under those conditions. I think the majority of people do not. So I think it's really important to know their working styles.
Right.
And actually, one thing, you know, one, I guess if you were to say one positive about the imposter syndrome is that I would not want to fall under the umbrella of the opposite of imposter syndrome, the Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't want...
What it is. What is that?
It's the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's quite literally overestimating your abilities. You're not having a sense of self-awareness and thinking that you are the best, when in actuality, you might need a little bit more humility.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure we've all met individuals like this.
Yes. Life sometimes teaches them something, though. I mean, along the way, they might learn some humility. But I don't know.
I think
you don't know about
people always say, like, why do bad things happen to good people? Bad things happen to good people. It just does.
All the time.
You know, the time.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. How does a gap year or more help or hurt applicants?
Yeah, so... It can help and it can hurt, right? So I just
want to be more than 1 year. So
exactly. And I do want to remind people that it's becoming more common for folks to get gap years across many different life stages, many different ages. There are folks who take gap years between high school and college and grad school, even in the middle of the career. I just had a conversation with someone this morning who took a gap year, went to college, had a career in industry for 13 years, took a gap year in her 40s, and is now starting a graduate program.
Wow.
So it's super interesting to hear about these gap years. And it really, I think what matters is, how are you using this time intentionally and strategically to prepare for the next step? And this might mean that you decide, okay, I'm going to use this time to gain some additional experience to fill a gap. Maybe it's volunteer experience, maybe it's work experience. Maybe you need to take a couple of classes to maybe round out some of your skill sets. Maybe you want to use this time to study abroad, to immerse yourself and learn a new language that will help you with the foreign language requirement for a graduate program. All of this to say that it's really about how you use your time, and also how you frame the way that you use that time when you apply to those programs.
Excellent point.
So funny, because I've been thinking and breathing and dreaming maybe about gap years. It's something that's come up in the program where I work. And so recently, in the McNair Scholars Program, one of the mandates, that's a federally funded, nationally recognized program to prepare undergrads, low-income, first-gen low-income and underrepresented students for grad study. Ideally, doctoral programs. We want them to go, the program requires/asks people to go straight from undergrad to grad school. So that is always our mandate in trying to get our students to go. So they conducted a study, the McNair Fast Facts came out from 2019, 2020, just got released or very recently. And what this is what they found. They found that if you take a gap year between 1 and 3 years, you're more than likely to get your PhD within 10 years than if you did not take a gap year.
Really?
So, so if people take do not take a gap year, they found that 14% of people get their PhDs within 10 years. People who took a gap year between 1 and 3 years, it's 28% or a little bit, something like that. It's higher. And then people who took a gap year more than 3 years, it's 7%. So it really drops. I mean, this is not to discourage non-traditional people, but it gets harder. I mean, the fact is that it gets much, much harder. And then in the cohorts of the McNair scholars, they also found that in terms of gap years, that 50% of people take gap years of the students. Wow. And I just was like, here we were beating ourselves up. The fact that so many students want to take gap years, right? And actually their faculty mentors will tell them, if you want to go into clinical psych, you need this research. It's just, you know, they tell them, yeah, do this route, you go to get a master's degree and then go into the PhD. So definitely the gap year is something that is very real. And I think Yvette, you know, made a really good point on how you need to just explain how that fits into your trajectory, right? How that makes sense for you.
But yeah,
so gap years.
Okay. What advice today would you give to yourselves, however many years ago it was that you were applying to graduate school?
Well, if this book existed, I would say go and read the book, right?
Okay, so that they fair know. Enough. Absolutely. Absolutely.
The plug. There's the plug, right?
Right?
So that they know the how. This is how you apply every step of the way. But in terms of advice, if I were thinking about like my former self, you know, or any, you know, young applicant today or new applicant or non-traditional, you name it, anyone who's thinking about applying, this is what I wish somebody would have told me. I wish somebody would have told me, know what it is that you stand for. Know what your strengths are and lean into your strengths. Build community of all types, you know, across all kinds of areas, industries. And know at the end of the day that you have options, that even if you're on one career path, the skills that you learn in college and in graduate programs are often transferable. And I know that because I'm living proof of it. I have pivoted multiple times in my career. I wouldn't be surprised if I continue to pivot because I lean into those things of like strengths, community building, and really what's becoming more common, I want to mention today among like the career development world is folks crafting what you call portfolio careers, which is where you are selecting different things that are part of your work, are part of your income sources, and not relying solely on one source of income or one full-time job. That's becoming more common now. And what's also becoming more common is pivoting. It's rare to find someone, I don't know the numbers, but I think it's something like 75% of people who major in one thing in college end up in a career path that's different from that major. So it's not realistic to expect that the 18-year-old you is going to have the same interests as the 40 or even 60-year-old you. So those are a couple of things I would say. I feel like I have a lot to say, but wow. I'll keep it brief with that.
Okay. Okay. Dr. Chavez Garcia.
Yeah. Everything she just said of just like, what? I hadn't thought about those things. So thank you for that, Yvette. I was just like thinking very, very narrowly, like I would apply to more schools. And the other one's to think about whether I want to teach or not. So teaching is, they don't teach you how to teach in grad school. It's something that takes up 80% of your time, even though it's only counted as a smaller portion, supposedly. But, and it, you would be, maybe not Linda, but you would be surprised how many faculty members try to get out of teaching.
That's no, I wouldn't R1. Be surprised actually.
Right. And so just the teaching portion is not easy. There's some gifted teachers. I have worked really hard at teaching and it's yeah, it takes up a lot of time. So think about that. But I think though, as we, in our conversation helped me think about how key the relationships with faculty are. And I was trying to remember back to my undergrad days and I had a small research experience, two small ones that helped me get into grad school. And I realized had I developed those more, maybe I would have learned whether I wanted to do it or not. I would have learned about my strengths. I didn't know I had what my strengths were at that time. I think the strengths. So everything Yvette's saying about learning your strength or understanding your strengths or trying to map those is really important. But yeah, it's kind of a blur, but I don't know. I think the fumbling in the dark is still a good metaphor for me. So but I'm just grateful to have those supportive people.
One of the things, I'll answer my own question in this case. Mm-hmm. I am the child of immigrants, as I mentioned, and my parents were very supportive of my sister and me pursuing higher education, but they really wanted us to go into a profession. You became a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, et cetera. And it was only when I got out of school that after I got my MBA, that I realized there are so many, there's an infinite number of ways that you can support yourself, that you can contribute to society. There are so many different ways you can go. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in terms of pivoting. And of course, it's not a life sentence either. I think that was your point. You can start on one path and then pivot. You can change.
Yeah. So, I always say I tell students, like, you know, there's different means of similar ends. So maybe a lot of us believe in social justice. How can that be done? It can be done many different ways. And I remember in grad school in particular, we always had this sort of, because we weren't activists in the streets, right? That we're like, I need to go pick up a picket sign and do, you know, and I remember listening to Cornel West back many years ago. And one of the things he said was like, you know, we need a division of labor to get this work done. You know, he's like, do you think Toni Morrison wrote her book by marching out there? No, she needed time to write. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm going to be a Toni Morrison or something, but he made a really good point about division of labor. I don't know if that was myself compromising and what space I should be in, but I knew I needed to be doing the research, doing the writing to get that research out there into the hands of the community that I wanted to know about themselves, know their history. But it is an internal thing that becomes difficult sometimes in thinking about where should I be and where should I locate myself.
Right. What do you wish I would have asked you? And either one of you can start.
Yeah.
How's that?
I can't think of anything offhand. I've had fun talking to you. It's thank you.
You're welcome.
Your list of questions were so thorough. I really enjoyed it. I'm at a loss for words because I don't have any other questions to answer.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for the feedback. Dr. Chavez Garcia and Dr. Martina Zhu, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners learn more about or purchase Is Grad School for Me? Demystifying the application process for first-gen BIPOC students.
Yeah, so they can get their copy today if they wanted to at isgradschoolforme.com. And then we also have a 30% off discount code. It is UCPSAVE30. If you go to the UC Press website or just Google UC Press Is Grad School for Me and use that code, you'll get 30% off on as many copies as you want to order. If you want to place a bulk order, reach out to us. We'll get you bigger discounts.
Okay. Sounds good.
And speaking gigs too. So throw that
in. All right. Well, you know, now know where to get this wonderful book and, I suggest you go do it and take advantage of the discount too. Listener, thank you too for tuning in today for this, our 575th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a suggestion. Subscribe. That way you won't miss any of the future shows, whether with fascinating authors, admissions directors, writing experts, test prep pros, fantastic admissions consultants, or alumni doing great things. You can find subscribe links in the show notes at exceba.com/575. And a quick reminder, master the paradox at the heart of admissions by downloading our free guide, Fitting In and Standing Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions. Grab your copy at exceba.com/FISO, as in fitting in and standing out. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.